Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're plunging into a truly fascinating case study, I think. It's an energy giant that finds itself at, well, a profound crossroads, Ecopetrol S.A. This isn't just about, another oil company. This is about Colombia's national oil company, a real cornerstone of its economy, and the incredibly complex forces shaping its very future right now.
That's right.
Our mission for this deep dive is really to try and cut through all the noise, the financial reports, the political rhetoric, and give you, our listener, a comprehensive, balanced understanding of Ecopetrol's unique position.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
We're going to explore everything from its deep-seated roots in traditional oil and gas to its ambitious, diversification efforts, all while it's navigating some truly significant political and economic headwinds. A story of legacy, transition, and, well, national identity, really.
What's truly captivating here, I think, is how Ecopetrol's journey serves as a kind of microcosm. It reflects the larger global tensions we see playing out today around energy security, the urgent push for climate goals, and crucially, economic stability. This is especially true for a country like Colombia, which remains, deeply reliant on its hydrocarbon sector. It's more than just a business case. It's a living window into the broader energy transition dilemmas and the intricate, often paradoxical challenges faced by state-owned enterprises worldwide.
And those unique challenges are precisely why this case is so illuminating, I feel.
Mm.
To help us navigate Ecopetrol's complex world, we've gathered, well, a stack of detailed analyses, financial reports, strategic documents.
Quite a bit of material.
Yeah. Get ready for some surprising facts, perhaps, and definitely some crucial insights as we explore what makes this company tick, what defines its current struggles, and what possible futures might lie ahead. So let's begin with the sheer scale of Ecopetrol. This isn't just a company in Colombia. It is quite emphatically the company. You could almost say it's synonymous with the nation's economic output in many ways.
That's absolutely right. Ecopetrol stands as Colombia's largest corporation, and as its national oil company, it operates with a fully integrated model.
Integrated meaning.
Meaning it controls the entire hydrocarbon value chain. So from the very beginning stages of upstream exploration and production.
Right, finding and drilling.
Exactly. Through the critical midstream of transportation and logistics, pipelines, storage, all the way to the downstream refining and petrochemicals. It's a behemoth that touches almost every part of the energy supply in the country.
And its size isn't just about its operational footprint, is it? It's deeply rooted in its ownership structure. The Colombian government holds, what is it, an overwhelming 88.49% stake.
That's the figure, 88.49%.
Here's the critical insight I think you need to grasp. Ecopetrol isn't just a company, it's practically an arm of the state. Its dominant government ownership isn't just a statistic. Analysts say it's the single most critical factor dictating its every strategic move, often prioritizing national economic and fiscal policies over pure, unadulterated corporate profit.
Absolutely. It leads to that constant balancing act.
It's truly a pillar, perhaps even the primary pillar
Yeah,
of the nation's economy.
indeed. To further underscore that dominance, just consider this. Ecopetrol is responsible for pumping out over 60% of all Colombia's hydrocarbon production.
Wow, over 60%.
Yeah. Beyond that, it owns and operates the vast majority of the nation's midstream and downstream infrastructure, the pipelines, the refineries. So this isn't merely a company that contributes to the national economy. It essentially is a significant vital organ of the economy. This level of state ownership means there's an inherent, almost constant tension. Ecopetrol's corporate strategy often has to perform this delicate balancing act between purely commercial imperatives like maximizing shareholder value and broader national interests, which, let's be honest, aren't always aligned, especially when you look at long-term energy planning versus, say, immediate fiscal needs for the government budget.
Right. So we have this colossus, a foundational piece of Colombia, yet it's facing a global environment and, crucially, a domestic government that's trying to usher in a whole new energy era. This isn't just about shifting strategy. It fundamentally challenges Ecopetrol's very identity, doesn't it? How does such a traditional giant, so deeply intertwined with its nation's fossil fuel economy, navigate a world that's increasingly pushing for an energy transition?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Which brings us right to the rapidly shifting landscape it faces.
Precisely. Ecopetrol is truly at what many analysts are calling a critical juncture. It's caught between its historical traditional role as an oil and gas producer and a very challenging, rapidly evolving domestic political landscape. It's like standing on a tightrope, trying to move forward while looking in two different directions at once.
And what does that challenging landscape look like on the ground? I mean, the sources we've reviewed highlight what they call a fundamental tension. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. On one side, Ecopetrol, as a responsible energy company, any energy company, really desperately needs to replace its dwindling proven reserves. That's just basic business survival to ensure its long-term viability.
Standard practice. You pump it out, you got to find more.
Exactly. But on the other side, the current Colombian administration has adopted a pretty staunch anti-fossil fuel stance and is actively pushing for a rapid energy transition agenda.
So these two forces are pulling in opposite directions.
Directly opposing directions. This isn't just a business challenge for Ecopetrol. Analysts are calling it an existential one. It strikes right at the core of its primary operations, its traditional bread and butter.
And the primary risk stemming from that stance is?
The primary risk, as clearly identified by multiple analyses, is the current Colombian administration's explicit policy of halting new oil and gas exploration licenses.
Well, halting new licenses.
Okay. Think about the implications of that for a moment. This policy immediately puts a hard cap on long-term growth for the traditional business. Without new discoveries, Ecopetrol is effectively on a timer, with its existing reserves just steadily depleting year after year.
Wow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this isn't just an Ecopetrol problem, really. It's a stark microcosm of the global energy dilemma. How do you transition away from fossil fuels when they are, right now, the primary engine of your economy and the main source of revenue for funding those very ambitious climate goals?
Right. It's like cutting off your funding source for the transition itself.
It's a fundamental paradox, a kind of self-inflicted wound that many nations are grappling with. But Colombia's situation illustrates it with acute clarity, perhaps more than most.
Given that immense pressure, that paradox, it sounds like Ecopetrol needed a bold, perhaps even desperate strategic move to, you know, create some breathing room or a new path forward.
Uh-huh.
And it certainly made one back in 2021 with that massive ISA acquisition.
Absolutely. The acquisition of a 51.4% controlling stake in Interconexión Eléctrica S.A., known as ISA, from the Colombian government itself in August 2021 was a truly landmark strategic shift. No other way to put it.
Landmark how?
Well, this single transaction fundamentally transformed Ecopetrol. It went from being essentially a pure play, albeit integrated, oil and gas company into a much broader, diversified energy and infrastructure conglomerate.
So not just oil and gas anymore?
Not at all. It wasn't just an incremental step. It was a quantum leap in its business model, a real pivot.
And ICE isn't some small domestic player, is it? My understanding is it's a titan in its own right.
Oh, definitely. ISA is Latin America's largest power transmission company. It boasts an extensive network that spans not just Colombia, but also Brazil, Peru, and Chile.
Okay, so that's not just diversification within energy. That's major geographical spread, too. And a significant shift in business focus away from just Colombia.
It is. And the strategic benefits are remarkably clear and compelling when you look at it. ISA provides Ecopetrol with highly stable, remarkably predictable, regulated, and crucially, largely U.S. dollar denominated cash flows.
Regulated cash flows. That sounds good. Less volatile.
Much less volatile. These revenues stem from long-term concessions in electricity transmission and also from toll roads, which ISA also operates. These are inherently less volatile than, you know, the often brutal swings in commodity prices that define Ecopetrol's traditional oil and gas business.
So it's a hedge against oil price swings.
It's a powerful hedge, yes, and a much-needed diversification. But what's even more fascinating strategically is that this acquisition represents more than just a simple energy transition play. Some analysts see it as a critical strategic hedge against domestic political risk.
How so?
By acquiring a business whose cash flows are largely insulated, being regulated, geographically diverse, and dollar-denominated Ecopetrol effectively shields a significant portion of its future earnings from the direct policy decisions of its own majority shareholder, the Colombian government.
Ah, interesting. So it gives them some independence, financially speaking, from Colombian politics.
Some insulation, exactly, which, as we discussed earlier, remains a paramount concern given the government's influence.
So with this dramatic new direction, this big acquisition, how is Ecopetrol actually articulating its vision and planning its future? Our sources delve into what they call the Energy that Transforms strategy. Sounds ambitious.
It is ambitious. Their overarching 2040 strategy, which is titled Energy that Transforms, is built upon four very clear pillars.
Okay, what are they?
First, consistently generating competitive returns for its shareholders. Standard enough. Second, pursuing growth with a very explicit energy transition focus, so acknowledging that shift.
Right.
Third, creating significant value through technology, environmental, social, and governance factors. They actually use the acronym TSG, which is a bit broader than just ESG.
The T is okay. Technology included.
Exactly. And finally, fostering cutting-edge knowledge and innovation throughout the organization. So it's a comprehensive vision that attempts to bridge the old world and the new.
Okay, let's unpack this. This ambitious vision translates into what they've termed a dual-track capital allocation framework, especially for 2024.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at a budget between COP23 and 27 trillion, which, for our international listeners, is roughly 5.6 to 6.6 billion U.S. dollars. So if I'm picturing this right, it's like Ecopetrol is trying to run two completely different businesses simultaneously, one that's the legacy powerhouse and another that's building the future.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. It must be an incredible balancing act internally.
It sounds like it.
And the numbers in their capital budget perfectly reflect this delicate balancing act. A substantial portion, between $3.5 billion and $4.1 billion, is still strategically allocated to the traditional exploration and production segment.
So still investing heavily in oil and gas.
Absolutely. This is crucial for sustaining current production levels. Their target is 725,000 to 730,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. It underscores their commitment to maximizing value from their existing core hydrocarbon business, even as they face those political headwinds we discussed.
Got to keep the cash flowing.
Precisely. But simultaneously, a very significant sum between $2.27 billion and $2.66 billion is specifically earmarked for energy transition projects.
Okay, like what kind of projects?
This includes expanding natural gas supply, which is seen as a critical transition fuel, various decarbonization initiatives across their operations, and importantly, funding the expansion of ISA's power transmission network across Latin America.
Ah, feeding the new acquisition.
Exactly. It is indeed a very complex, delicate dance between maintaining their legacy cash cow and aggressively investing in their future energy identity.
Let's dig even deeper now into those core operations, starting with the very heart of their traditional business, upstream. This is where they, you know, explore for and produce crude oil and natural gas.
The upstream segment, as you said, it's the beating heart, but it presents a fascinating and, frankly, rather concerning paradox.
A paradox. How so?
You see impressive operational resilience in the short term, juxtaposed against serious questions about long-term health.
Okay, tell me about the resilience first.
Ecopetrol has actually shown surprisingly strong operational performance recently. Average production hit 746,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day in 2024.
746 carabod. That's quite high, isn't it?
It's remarkable, actually, a 9-year high for them. This performance has been driven by successful development campaigns in existing fields and solid contributions from their international assets, like in the U.S. Permian Basin.
That sounds genuinely good on the surface, a testament to their operational prowess, maybe.
Yeah.
But you hinted at long-term health being a significant concern. Where does that worry come into play amidst these strong production numbers?
The concern lies squarely in their proven reserves. While proven reserves were at a multi-year high of 2.011 billion barrels of oil equivalent at the end of 2022, a very healthy number,
mm-hmm.
they've since trended downward. They reported 1.89 billion BO by year-end 2024.
Okay, so a decline. Why?
Well, this decline is not a surprise. It's a direct and, you could say, inevitable consequence of producing more barrels of oil and gas than they are able to add back through new discoveries or significant reevaluation of existing fields. They're effectively consuming their asset base faster than they can replenish it, especially without new exploration licenses.
So even though their reserve replacement ratio, the RRR, was, I saw, a seemingly positive 104% in 2024.
Right, which sounds good on paper.
Yeah, to a casual observer, that might sound robust. But you're saying it's not truly from finding new oil fields in the traditional sense? It's a bit of a statistical illusion, almost.
That's a crucial distinction and a really insightful way to put it. That 104% RRR is primarily being achieved not through brand new frontier exploration successes, because they can't really do that right now.
Right.
Instead, it's coming from revisions of existing field estimates and enhanced oil recovery, or EOR, projects. These techniques help extract more oil from already discovered reservoirs.
So squeezing more out of the old stuff.
Exactly. While important, analysts point out it is not through new exploration success, which means it's an unsustainable model for the long run. Consequently, the company's reserve life, that's the number of years current reserves would last at current production rates, has been steadily contracting.
How much has it contracted?
It went from a relatively comfortable 8.4 years at the end of 2022 down to approximately 7.1 years for oil and an even shorter 6.1 years for gas by mid-2024.
Wow. Only 7 years for oil, six for gas.
Yes. This short and contracting reserve life is flagged as a major structural risk. It implies the company is essentially liquidating its core long-term asset without a clear and consistent path to replacement. Think about it. Less than a decade of proven reserves for its primary business. It's like having a fuel tank that's steadily emptying with no clear path to the next gas station.
That's a stark image. So, while the upstream business is very much facing this existential clock, this countdown, let's talk about the midstream segment. This is consolidated through CNET, right? It sounds like the steady, reliable heartbeat of the company, maybe.
It absolutely is, and it truly earns that description. Ecopetrol's midstream operations are consolidated under its wholly owned subsidiary, CNET.
Wholly owned, okay.
And CNET operates what our sources describe as a near-monopolistic network of hydrocarbon transportation infrastructure across Colombia. Pipelines, storage, ports.
Near monopolistic, so they basically own the pipes.
Pretty much. CNET is a true financial ballast for Ecopetrol. It provides remarkably stable and predictable revenue streams, often under long-term contracts. This consistency helps to cushion the volatility inherent in the upstream production-focused side of the business.
And what does that impressive network actually consist of? What's the scale?
CNET's vast asset base includes approximately 9,000 kilometers of crude oil and refined product pipelines.
9,000 kilometers.
It's extensive, along with significant storage facilities and crucial port terminals for export. Key assets include the Ocensa pipeline, which is Colombia's largest and most crucial crude oil export artery. It has a capacity of 590,000 barrels per day.
Huge capacity.
And then there's the Caña Limón-Coveñas pipeline. It's incredibly important for transporting crude from fields in eastern Colombia, but it's also, unfortunately, frequently targeted by illegal armed groups.
The security issue again.
Yes, that makes it a persistent security challenge for them. Despite those significant security hurdles, though, the segment consistently demonstrates strong operational performance. It transported volumes exceeding 1.1 million barrels per day, 11,119 kilobd in 2024. It's a highly robust, indispensable, and generally very profitable part of the company's portfolio.
Okay, so a stable backbone. Now, moving on to the downstream side. Ecopetrol also has a firm, almost complete grip on the country's refining and petrochemical sectors, essentially fueling Colombia directly, right?
Yes, this is another area of immense strategic importance. Ecopetrol owns and operates all of Colombia's major refineries.
All of them, wow.
Yes, giving it effective control over the entire domestic fuel supply. It acts as the primary, often sole, wholesaler of fuels in the country, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. It ensures the lights stay on and the economy keeps moving.
Which refineries are we talking about?
The two main facilities are the Barranca Bermeja refinery, that's the largest and oldest, with a capacity of about 230,000 barrels per day, and the Cartagena refinery, which is a more modern, technologically advanced facility with a capacity of roughly 210,000 barrels per day.
So combined, that's a truly significant refining capacity of 440,000 barrels per day. And it sounds like they're running these operations incredibly efficiently, which, you know, is no small feat for facilities of this scale.
Indeed. The company reported exceptionally high operational availability, reaching 94.5% in 2024. That's very good for refineries. They also had strong utilization rates across both facilities. Consolidated throughput, the total volume processed, reached an impressive 414 kiloday in 2024.
So they're running them hard and well.
They are. This operational excellence ensures a steady, reliable supply of gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and other refined products to the domestic market. That's crucial for Colombia's energy security and just everyday economic functioning.
Okay. So these operational details, they paint a picture of a fundamentally capable company, a well-oiled machine, if you'll pardon the pun. But here's the crucial question. How do these undeniable operational strengths interact with and respond to the broader, often turbulent, economic and political environment in Colombia?
Exactly. That's where the real story unfolds, where the rubber meets the road.
We've touched on it, but let's really zoom out now and look at the Colombian oil and gas sector as a whole. Because it's not just a big part of the national economy. For many, it is the foundation.
It truly is an absolute cornerstone of Colombia's economy. This sector, primarily driven by Ecopetrol, accounts for approximately 5.3% of the nation's gross domestic product.
5.3% of GDP.
Significant. Very significant. Even more dramatically, it generates over half, more than 50% of Colombia's total export earnings. That brings in crucial foreign currency, and it contributes more than 10% of total government revenues.
Wow, 10% of the government's money comes from this sector.
Over 10%, funding everything from education to infrastructure. As Latin America's third largest oil producer, the fundamental health and stability of this industry, and therefore Ecopetrol, is just inextricably linked to the country's macroeconomic stability and its ability to pay for social programs and future development.
And here's where we run smack into that strategic paradox you mentioned earlier. It's a truly mind-bending problem, isn't it?
It really is.
The government has this ambitious, laudable energy transition plan that requires billions in funding. But the primary source of that funding, the golden goose, is the very industry it's trying to constrain and phase out by banning new exploration licenses.
Mm-hmm.
This, as our sources highlight, creates a fiscally unsustainable situation. It's like trying to build a new house by demolishing the one you're currently living in and then using its scraps to pay the builders. Just sounds like a recipe for a very uncomfortable and maybe expensive transition.
It's an exceptionally clear and challenging contradiction, and one that carries immediate, tangible consequences. Consider the natural gas crisis that's emerging.
What's happening with natural gas?
Colombia, a nation that has historically been self-sufficient in natural gas, actually lost that self-sufficiency in late 2024.
Really? They're importing gas now?
Yes, they've already become reliant on expensive LNG imports. And projections show a widening supply gap for natural gas in the coming years.
Which means?
Which could lead to significantly higher energy costs for industries and households, and even potential shortages down the line. This isn't just an inconvenience. Analysts see it posing a profound and significant economic risk to the entire nation.
Mm.
It really raises that important question. Can a nation truly transition away from its primary economic engine without first securing alternative, equally robust, and consistently flowing revenue streams? Colombia's situation illustrates this acute dilemma with stark reality.
And beyond these policy and economic paradoxes, there are also those very real, persistent, on-the-ground challenges, particularly concerning security and just maintaining operations in volatile regions.
Absolutely. Security challenges represent a persistent, costly, and frankly dangerous operational risk for Ecopetrol. Illegal armed groups, most notably the National Liberation Army, or ELN, frequently target and sabotage critical infrastructure, especially oil and gas pipelines.
We mentioned the Caño Limón pipeline earlier.
That's a prime example. The consequences of these attacks are severe and multifaceted. You get production shut-ins, which means lost revenue. You get environmental damage, often catastrophic, requiring a costly cleanup. And Ecopetrol incurs massive security and repair costs just trying to protect and fix its assets.
Is it getting worse?
Reports from 2024 and 2025 indicate a deteriorating security environment in several key operating regions. So yes, the analysis suggests these disruptions are likely to increase, adding another layer of significant risk and considerable cost to doing business in the country. We're talking about direct physical disruptions that impact national output.
Okay. Now, on a broader, more global level, Ecopetrol also has to contend with the global energy context. That means the ever-present price volatility of crude oil and, crucially, those fluctuating price differentials for specific crude types.
Precisely. While Colombia is a significant regional oil producer, it's simply not large enough to single-handedly influence global oil prices like, say, Saudi Arabia or Russia.
It's a price taker, not a price maker.
Exactly. And its production is primarily composed of heavy, sour crude oil grades. A key benchmark for their exports is called Castilla Blend.
Heavy sour crude. What does that mean for pricing?
What's crucial for understanding Ecopetrol's revenue is that heavy sour crudes typically trade at a discount to lighter, sweeter grades like Brent or West Texas Intermediate, WTI.
Why the discount?
Because they are more energy intensive and costly to refine into high value products like gasoline and diesel.
Mm.
Refineries need specific, often more complex equipment to process them.
So this differential means Ecopetrol doesn't just get the headline Brent price. They get Brent minus a discount. And you're saying that discount isn't fixed. That adds another layer of complexity.
You're exactly right. That differential isn't static. It's a moving target. It's constantly shifting based on a complex interplay of factors.
Like what?
Things like the global supply and demand balance for heavy versus light crude. The specific demand from refineries configured to process certain types of crude, even shipping costs and geopolitical events can impact it.
Can you give an example of how much it fluctuates?
Sure. For example, in early 2025, the discount for Castilla blend relative to Brent narrowed to approximately $3.50 per barrel. That was a significant improvement from the much wider $15.17 per barrel differential observed back in early 2023.
Yep. Wow, that's a huge swing from $15 down to $3 down to 50 cents.
Huge. So to accurately forecast Ecopetrol's revenue, you need to understand not just the headline Brent price, but also the dynamic, fluctuating nature of this heavy crude differential. It adds significant volatility.
Okay, so all these macro and operational realities paint a vivid picture of the challenges. Now, how do these translate into Ecopetrol's actual financial performance? Let's turn our attention to the numbers. So given all these internal dynamics and external pressures, the politics, the security, the oil price swings, the differentials, let's turn to Ecopetrol's actual financial numbers. Their historical performance, not surprisingly, shows a strong correlation with that global commodity wave.
Indeed. Ecopetrol's financial performance is, as you might expect, highly cyclical. It's directly correlated with global crude oil prices. The sensitivity is starkly clear when you look at the data.
Not clear.
Revenues peaked dramatically during the high price environment of 2022. They soared to $35.3 billion. That translated into a very robust net income of $7.0 billion.
Big numbers in a high price year.
Very big. Then, in 2024, as global prices moderated somewhat, revenue was still strong at $33.7 billion, though net income naturally softened to $3.8 billion. This inherent cyclicality is a defining feature of the business. You can see it clearly in the past, too. The company experienced a significant net loss back in 2015 during a major oil price downturn.
Right, I remember that downturn. Mm-hmm. But despite that inherent volatility, the company still manages to show strong underlying profitability and operational control, which sounds like quite an achievement in such a demanding environment.
Yes, that's a crucial point often overlooked amidst the noise. Their EBITDA margin, that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, a key measure of operational profitability, was an exceptional 47.2% in the boom year of 2022.
Nearly 50 cents on the dollar before those items.
Exactly. And it remained remarkably robust at 41% in 2024, even with lower prices. This consistently high margin indicates truly effective operational cost control. It's a testament to their management capabilities on the ground.
What about returns?
Return on equity, or ROE, also highlights its efficiency. It reached an impressive 34.7% in 2022, moderating to 18.7% in 2024, still a very strong showing for the industry. However, free cash flow generation, which is a critical indicator of financial flexibility, is by its very nature also highly volatile. It swung from a substantial $17.5 billion in 2022 during that peak commodity cycle. Well, it fluctuates greatly depending on price and investment.
Now let's talk about how they allocate that hard-earned capital, because this is where the Colombian government's heavy hand as the majority owner really comes into play, creating some fundamental tension, right?
Yes. Capital allocation at Ecopetrol perfectly reflects its dual mandate that we discussed. On one hand, it needs to fund its own strategic growth and operational continuity. On the other, it serves as an absolutely major revenue source for the Colombian government.
So how does that play out in their spending?
Capital expenditures, or CapEx, have been steadily ramping up from the post-pandemic lows. They totaled $6.1 billion in 2024. Approximately 70% of that budget, a significant majority, was directed towards the upstream production segment.
70% still going to oil and gas production.
Yes. This spending is crucially aimed at sustaining output from existing fields, as we discussed earlier, essentially trying to squeeze more from what they already have, especially given the absence of new exploration opportunities.
And then there are those substantial dividends. I saw that the 2022 dividend payout was the highest in the company's entire history.
It was enormous.
Their formal policy targets 60% of the prior year's net income, plus the potential for extraordinary dividends on top of that. This sounds fantastic for the government's budget, but what does it mean for the company itself long term?
This is precisely where the structural conflict truly comes to light, and it's a classic example of the challenges state-owned enterprises face globally. The Colombian government relies heavily, very heavily, on Ecopetrol's dividends to plug gaps in its national budget.
So there's pressure for big payouts.
Intense pressure for consistently high payouts. While this provides immediate fiscal relief to the state, it directly reduces the retained earnings available for crucial long-term investments within Ecopetrol.
Such as?
We're talking about essential capital for things like those enhanced oil recovery projects needed to prolong existing field life. developing those promising but expensive offshore gas discoveries, and aggressively executing their own stated energy transition strategy.
So the dividends are potentially hindering the transition.
In essence, yes. It starves the company of internally generated capital. This forces it to rely more heavily on external debt to fund these necessary investments, thereby increasing its financial leverage and risk profile. This tension between the short-term fiscal needs of the government owner and the long-term strategic health and investment requirements of the company is a classic risk inherent in state-controlled enterprises. It's a fundamental trade-off that often compromises future growth.
So with this constant pressure for payouts, what does their overall financial health actually look like, particularly their debt levels and credit ratings?
As of year-end 2024, Ecopetrol's total debt stood at a substantial $27.24 billion U.S. dollars. Their gross debt-to-EBITDA ratio was a manageable 2.2 times.
2.2x? That's not too alarming in itself.
No, it's generally considered acceptable, though it had increased from 1.5 times at the end of 2022. This uptick was primarily due to a combination of lower EBITDA as commodity prices normalized and those continued high investment levels, plus the big dividend payouts.
And their credit ratings, what do they signal?
Their credit ratings, like Fitch's BB+ and Moody's B1, are intrinsically linked to and effectively capped by the sovereign rating of Colombia itself.
Ah, so the country's rating limits the company's rating.
Essentially, yes. These are generally considered speculative grade or high yield ratings. They reflect the perceived macroeconomic and political risks associated with the country as a whole, rather than just Ecopetrol's standalone operational performance or financial metrics. The sovereign risk weighs heavily.
And they also have significant currency exposure, right? That's a constant balancing act for any international company, but particularly one like Ecopetrol with its specific revenue cost structure.
They absolutely do. Their revenues from crude oil sales are predominantly U.S. dollar denominated, given that oil is traded globally in dollars.
Right.
However, a large portion of their operating costs, domestic taxes, and importantly, those large dividend payments are denominated in Colombian pesos.
So, USD income. COP expenses and payouts. What does that mean?
It creates a kind of natural hedge against a weakening peso because their dollar revenues become more valuable in local currency terms. But conversely, a sharp appreciation of the COP against the USD would negatively impact their reported earnings when translated back into pesos. Sharp fluctuations in the USD-COP exchange rate can materially impact their reported financial results, introducing another layer of financial volatility.
Okay, so with all these intricate financial details, the constant push and pull of capital allocation, and the macro-level pressures, how does the market actually view Ecopetrol? Let's talk about its valuation. When we look at Ecopetrol compared to its peers in the global energy market, what immediately jumps out is this phenomenon that many analysts refer to as the Colombia discount. It suggests the market isn't fully valuing the company's assets or earnings potential.
It's a very real and persistent phenomenon, yes. A direct comparison of Ecopetrol's valuation multiples things like price-to-earnings ratios against other regional state-controlled entities like Brazil's Petrobras and Argentina's YPF reveals a valuation that is heavily influenced by its specific sovereign and political risk profile.
So it's penalized for where it operates and who owns it, basically.
That's a good way to put it. It's essentially penalized for those factors, irrespective of its operational performance sometimes.
So what does that look like in hard numbers? What's the scale of this discount we're talking about?
Ecopetrol consistently trades at a notably low price-to-earnings, or PE, ratio. It was around 5.9 times based on mid-2025 estimates.
5.9 times earnings. How does that compare?
It's quite comparable to Petrobras in Brazil, which trades at an even lower PE of about 4.5 times. This signals that the market applies a significant discount to these companies due to the inherent political risks associated with state-controlled entities in the region, where national interests can, and often do, supersede pure profit motives or minority shareholder interests.
And how does that compare to, say, major international oil companies?
To put that into broader perspective, major international oil companies think ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, which operate with less direct government interference and often have more geographically diversified portfolios, frequently trade at PE ratios above 10x, sometimes even significantly higher.
So roughly half the valuation multiple or even less?
In many cases, yes. But then there's that counterintuitive exceptionally high dividend yield you sometimes see with Ecopetrol. I saw Fendel's mentioning 16.9% to 19.5% recently.
Wow, yields like 17%, 19%. That's incredibly attractive to income investors looking for yield. How does that square with a discounted valuation? Doesn't a high yield usually mean the market likes the income stream?
You've hit on a crucial point that can be misleading. While indeed attractive on the surface, such an extraordinarily high dividend yield is often a signal of high risk and perceived unsustainability rather than pure generosity or strength.
So the high yield is actually a warning sign.
It typically reflects a depressed stock price due to perceived risks. In essence, the market is demanding a much higher dividend return to compensate investors for the elevated political, economic, and operational risks it perceives. Those risks are baked into that lower share price, which mathematically pushes the yield percentage up. It's not necessarily a sign of a healthy, growing company, but rather one where investors see significant uncertainty about the future, including the sustainability of that dividend itself.
Okay, that makes sense. So if we look at Ecopetrol's own history, is this current low valuation an anomaly, or is it consistent with past periods of uncertainty for them?
Ecopetrol's current P/E ratio is actually quite consistent with its own historical single-digit valuations during previous periods of significant political or economic uncertainty in Colombia. The market has, unfortunately for them, consistently applied this Colombia discount to the stock. And the current political environment, particularly the government's stance on exploration, has likely entrenched and perhaps even amplified this discount.
Now, you mentioned earlier that if we broke the company down, the parts might be worth more than the whole currently reflects. Can we talk about that sum of the parts idea?
Yes, the sum of the parts, or SOTP analysis. If we were to perform this, meticulously breaking down Ecopetrol's distinct business segments and valuing them independently based on their own risk profiles and cash flow characteristics, it would almost certainly reveal significant underlying value that is currently not reflected in the consolidated market capitalization.
That's a powerful point. Can you break down those parts for us and explain why they would warrant different multiples if they were standalone entities? This is where the unseen value might truly reside, maybe.
Certainly. Let's imagine Ecopetrol as three separate businesses for a moment, just hypothetically.
Okay.
First, you have the midstream segment, seen it. We talked about its stability. It operates almost like a utility company providing essential transportation services with regulated, often long-term contracts.
Right. The pipelines and storage.
Exactly. It generates incredibly stable and predictable cash flows, much like a steady stream of income from a long-term rental property. This inherent stability, its essential nature as infrastructure, is highly valued by investors and would typically command a much higher valuation multiple than a volatile oil producer if it were standalone. Think infrastructure funds, pension funds, they love assets like this.
Okay, so seeing it should be worth more on its own multiple. What's next?
Then there's the transmission segment, ISA, the big acquisition. This is also largely a regulated utility business, but it's geographically diversified across Latin America. It operates under long-term concessions, and crucially, a significant portion of its revenues are dollar-denominated.
Stability, diversification, dollar revenues.
All positives for valuation. This provides stability and a natural hedge against currency fluctuations, again, warranting a higher, more stable valuation multiple, more akin to an independent international power transmission company.
Got it. And the third piece?
Finally, you have the upstream and downstream segments. These are the traditional cyclical oil and gas exploration, production, and refining businesses. Their value is highly dependent on long-term oil price assumptions, global demand, refining margins, and most critically for Ecopetrol right now, the political outlook for reserve replacement.
So much more volatile and uncertain.
Inherently more volatile and uncertain, yes. These segments would command lower multiples, reflecting that higher risk profile and cyclicality.
So putting it all together.
The key insight here is that the consolidated company's currently low valuation multiple is driven almost entirely by the market's negative perception of the risks associated with the upstream business, specifically that exploration ban and the uncertainty it creates, and the overarching sovereign risk of Colombia.
So the risky parts are dragging down the value of the stable parts.
That's the argument.
Yeah.
The stable, high-quality cash flows from CNIT and ISA undoubtedly provide a significant margin of safety to the overall valuation, a protective floor. But this inherent value is often obscured and overshadowed by that pervasive political overhang and the market's fear about the future of the core oil business.
Which brings us directly then to a more comprehensive look at all the risks that truly define Ecopetrol's investment case. So let's dive into the full spectrum of challenges Ecopetrol faces. Our sources are incredibly clear that the most significant category of risk for this company, overshadowing almost all others, is regulatory and political.
Absolutely. This is the dominant existential factor. There's no getting around it. First and foremost, the government's policy of halting new oil and gas exploration licenses is, as our sources state flatly, an existential threat to Ecopetrol's long-term ability to replace its reserves and thus sustain its production.
Existential threat, strong words.
They are, but arguably justified. It directly undermines the value and future viability of the entire upstream business. Think about it. Without new discoveries, the company's core asset is simply being depleted year by year without a clear plan for replenishment approved by its main shareholder.
And then there's the ownership itself creating risk.
Yes, the pervasive influence of the majority shareholder. With the Colombian government owning that staggering 88.49% of the company, there's a substantial risk, constantly flagged by analysts, that strategic decisions will prioritize state fiscal needs, like balancing the national budget, over maximizing long-term value for all shareholders, including the minority ones.
Like the dividend issue we discussed.
Exactly. This often manifests through demands for unsustainably high dividends over critical reinvestment in the business's future. And finally, within political risk, there's the ongoing risk of changes to the tax regime. The oil and gas sector is such a vital source of tax revenue for Colombia that the government could, at any point, implement new taxes or increase royalty rates, directly impacting Ecopetrol's profitability and cash flow. It's always a target.
Okay, so beyond those high-level policy risks, there are also the very real, on-the-ground operational challenges. Okay, let's unpack this. It sounds like it's a constant battle on multiple fronts just to keep the oil flowing and the business running safely in many regions of Colombia.
That's a very apt description. Even if we were to magically set aside the political risks for a moment, operational challenges are incredibly significant and pervasive for Ecopetrol. Security threats are paramount.
The pipeline attacks.
Yes. Ecopetrol's vast network of pipelines and production facilities are frequent targets for sabotage by illegal armed groups. These attacks aren't just minor annoyances. They cause production shut-ins, leading to significant revenue losses, considerable environmental damage requiring costly cleanup, and massively increased security and repair costs.
And that situation is worsening.
Our sources indicate a deteriorating security environment reported in 2024 and into 2025, suggesting these disruptions are likely to increase, not decrease. This adds a heavy layer of cost and operational uncertainty to doing business in the country.
And then there's that critical challenge of reserve replacement you highlighted earlier. Even with existing assets, just maintaining production isn't a given, is it?
Precisely. Even if the exploration ban were lifted tomorrow, replacing reserves is a fundamental capital-intensive challenge for any mature oil company. With Ecopetrol's already short reserve life hovering around 7 years, this is identified as an acute risk.
Why acute?
Because they're so heavily dependent now on enhanced oil recovery techniques and developing existing, often smaller discoveries to offset production decline, this is inherently less certain, often more technically challenging, and typically more costly per barrel than finding brand new prolific fields through exploration.
Right. And then just the basic risks of the business itself.
Of course. You always have the inherent environmental and safety risks of large-scale oil and gas operations, the constant potential for spills, leaks, and industrial accidents. These can lead to significant financial liabilities, regulatory penalties, and profound reputational damage that takes years, if ever, to fully overcome.
Okay. And finally, let's touch on the financial and market risks. These are standard for the industry, but always seem to be magnified by the specific complexities of the Colombian context, don't they?
They do. First, obviously, is the direct exposure to the volatile prices of crude oil and natural gas. A sustained downturn in global energy prices would severely impact Ecopetrol's cash flow and, consequently, its ability to fund its extensive investment program and pay those dividends the government relies on.
And the currency risk.
Yes, currency risk remains significant. Their revenues are predominantly in U.S. dollars, while many operating expenses, taxes, and liabilities are in Colombian pesos. So, as we discussed, a sharp appreciation of the COP against the USD would negatively impact reported earnings, while a depreciation would help. It's a constant currency tightrope walk they have to manage.
And Colombia's own economy.
And finally, yes, as the country's largest company, Ecopetrol's financial performance is intrinsically tied to the overall health of the Colombian economy itself. A domestic recession could reduce local fuel demand, impacting their downstream refining profitability, and potentially exacerbate broader economic and political instability, creating a kind of negative feedback loop of risk. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these aren't isolated risks. They interact and amplify each other. Political decisions affect reserves, which affect financials. Security issues affect operations, which affect financials. Currency affects reported earnings. It creates a really complex, interwoven web of challenges for Ecopetrol to navigate daily.
So, with all these intricate internal and external pressures swirling around, how is the company actually being led and governed? Leadership and corporate governance are always critical, of course, but they become absolutely paramount when dealing with a state-owned enterprise of this magnitude and complexity.
They are indeed foundational, and Ecopetrol's senior leadership has seen significant changes in recent years, which directly reflect the influence of the current Colombian government. Ricardo Roa Barragán was appointed CEO in April 2023.
Okay, Roa Barragán. What's his background?
He's a mechanical engineer with extensive experience in the energy sector, notably serving as president of Grupo Energía de Bogotá, another major Colombian energy player, and also Transportadora de Gas International, TGI.
So a lot of gas and power experience.
Yes. His background is heavily weighted towards gas and power infrastructure, which analysts note aligns quite directly with the government's stated energy transition focus, perhaps more so than traditional oil exploration. His articulated priority, according to company statements, is to lead a fair and sustainable energy transition while simultaneously maintaining the company's crucial financial soundness. Tough balancing act.
Very tough. And the chairwoman of the board, she's relatively new too, isn't she?
Monica de Greiff Lindo was elected chairwoman in August 2025. She is a highly accomplished lawyer with a long and distinguished career in both public and private sectors. She even served as Colombia's Minister of Justice at one point and was also CEO of Grupo Energía de Bogotá, like Roa.
Okay, so high-profile figures, but they face a huge challenge, right?
An immense challenge, as our sources put it. This management team, led by these individuals, must somehow balance the often conflicting objectives of the majority shareholders' political agenda, the energy transition push, the fiscal needs, with the undeniable economic realities of the global energy market and the long-term commercial interests of Ecopetrol as a company with minority shareholders, too. It's a very, very difficult tightrope to walk daily.
And what about the broader corporate governance structure? How does the government's majority ownership fundamentally shape how Ecopetrol is run day to day, especially concerning things like transparency and protecting the rights of those minority shareholders?
Corporate governance at Ecopetrol is, as our sources highlight repeatedly, fundamentally shaped by that dominant government ownership. The board of directors consists of 9 members.
9 members.
Mm-hmm.
And the government appoints.
With its 88.49% stake, the government effectively controls appointments to the board. This often results in board members whose priorities might align more closely with government policy objectives than with traditional shareholder value maximization principles you might see elsewhere.
And there's been turnover.
Yes, there's been significant turnover on the board in recent years. The average tenure was noted as being very short, just 1.4 years as of mid-2025.
1.4 years average tenure. That's incredibly short for a board.
It is. It suggests a potential lack of stability and continuity at the highest level of oversight, which can definitely hinder long-term strategic planning and execution. The government's influence extends naturally to all major strategic decisions: CEO appointments, critical capital expenditure plans approval, and crucially, setting the dividend policy.
Which creates potential conflicts.
Exactly. It creates significant risk of conflicts of interest between the state's potentially short-term fiscal needs and the goal of long-term value maximization for all shareholders, particularly the minority ones who lack the government's clout.
So even though Ecopetrol is listed on both the Colombian Stock Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange, which usually implies certain governance standards, minority shareholder protection sounds quite limited in practice here.
That's precisely the situation many analysts describe. While Ecopetrol is indeed subject to important disclosure requirements and regulations due to its international listings, the overwhelming control wielded by the state fundamentally limits the effective power of minority shareholders to truly influence corporate policy or strategic direction.
So they're kind of along for the ride.
They largely have to trust that the government's decisions, driven ultimately by perceived national interest, will eventually align with long-term shareholder value. It's a big leap of faith sometimes. This really raises an important question that applies to many SOEs. How effectively can a company truly pursue stable, long-term strategic goals when its governance is so heavily influenced by what can often be short-term political and fiscal imperatives?
A critical question indeed. So, considering all these intricate factors, the operations, the politics, the finances, the governance, what does this ultimately mean for someone considering Ecopetrol from an investment perspective? Let's get into the investment thesis. So, if you're looking at Ecopetrol through an investor's lens, after everything we've discussed, what's the most optimistic view? What's the bull case for its future potential?
The bull case for Ecopetrol really hinges on what many investors hope will be the eventual triumph of economic pragmatism over political ideology.
Pragmatism wins out, essentially.
That's the core belief. The hope is that the Colombian government, faced with the undeniable reality of declining fiscal revenues from a shrinking oil sector and the growing severity of the potential natural gas crisis we talked about, will eventually be forced by sheer economic necessity to reverse, or at least significantly moderate, its ban on new exploration licenses. This shift would allow Ecopetrol to return to a more balanced, sustainable, and, well, economically rational energy policy. It's basically a gamble that necessity will ultimately dictate a change in political will.
And if that policy reversal, that hoped-for shift in political winds, actually materializes, what would be the primary drivers of value creation for Ecopetrol then? How would it benefit?
If that crucial policy reversal happens, analysts believe it would unlock several powerful value creation drivers. First, Ecopetrol has consistently demonstrated strong operational execution and impressively low production costs from its existing fields.
They run things well.
They do. In a supportive policy environment, especially if coupled with a sustained higher oil price globally, this operational leverage would allow them to generate massive free cash flow from both their existing and potentially newly developed assets.
Okay, so strong cash flow potential. What else?
Critically, the market currently undervalues those stable midstream assets, Senate, and the electricity transmission assets, ISA, largely because of the political overhang on the core oil business. A policy shift could lead the market to better appreciate these parts.
Re-rating the stable parts.
Exactly. These assets provide a strong, reliable cash flow stream and offer a significant margin of safety to the overall valuation. A change in sentiment could unlock that value. And finally, for income-oriented investors, that exceptionally high dividend yield, currently seen as a consequence of the depressed stock price and risk, could become even more attractive if the market perceives the payout as more sustainable under a more stable policy environment. It might look less like a risk signal and more like a genuine return.
It certainly sounds like a high-stakes gamble, though, doesn't it? A big bet on pragmatism winning out over firmly held political beliefs.
Yeah. Let's consider the other side, the bear case. What happens if the current political overhang persists and maybe even hardens? The bear case centers on the current political and regulatory environment becoming permanent, or at least entrenched, for the foreseeable future. This leads, according to this view, inevitably to the gradual liquidation of the company's core business. It paints a much, much bleaker picture.
Gradual liquidation. Okay, and what are the specific risks of value destruction in that scenario? What would that liquidation actually look like for the company on the ground?
Well, the continuation of the exploration ban would make a decline in reserves and production inevitable. We saw the reserve life is already down to around 7 years.
Right.
Without new fields, the upstream segment would effectively enter a terminal decline phase. Its primary earnings engine would steadily shrink and eventually, well, run out of fuel.
Compounded by other issues.
Yes. Compounding this, a deteriorating security situation across Colombia, if that trend continues, could lead to even more frequent and severe production disruptions, further eroding cash flow and profitability. It hits them from another angle.
And the capital issue.
There's also the persistent risk of capital starvation. If the government's demand for high dividends continues unabated to fund its budget, Ecopetrol would continue to be starved of the necessary capital for essential long-term investments. Things like EOR, developing those crucial offshore gas discoveries needed to avert the gas crisis, and adequately funding its own stated energy transition initiatives.
So it can't invest in its future.
It leads to a hollowing out of the company's asset base, both old and new. Ultimately, in this scenario, the market would increasingly price Ecopetrol as a company with a finite production life and limited growth potential, leading to permanently compressed or perhaps even further contracted valuation multiples. This scenario paints a vivid picture of Ecopetrol as a company slowly eating itself, unable to replace what it consumes, gradually shrinking into a much smaller, less profitable entity, perhaps eventually just being the pipeline and transmission company.
a stark contrast to the bull case. So, after weighing both the optimistic and pessimistic scenarios, what does this all mean when we assess the overall risk and reward for Ecopetrol? It seems like it's a very specific kind of bet an investor would be making.
That's exactly right. Investing in Ecopetrol today is fundamentally less a bet on geology or operational excellence and more a direct bet on the future political and economic trajectory of Colombia.
It's a country bet more than a company bet.
To a large extent, yes. The company's operational capabilities and its strong underlying asset base, particularly in midstream and transmission, are not really in doubt. But its ability to deploy them effectively for long-term value creation is severely constrained by its unique ownership structure and the prevailing political landscape.
Is there any protection on the downside?
The downside, however, is arguably protected to some extent by those stable, resilient cash flows from CNIT and ISA. They provide something of a floor value to the company. They act as a buffer against the worst-case upstream scenarios. However, the upside potential is clearly capped right now by that significant political uncertainty.
So what's the trigger for change?
A positive resolution, namely a return to a more pragmatic energy policy that allows for new exploration, could lead to a substantial re-rating of the stock, unlocking that hidden value in the sum of the parts. Conversely, an entrenchment of the current anti-exploration policies means the core upstream business slowly liquidates, turning Ecopetrol over time into a smaller, less profitable entity that would be heavily reliant on its regulated midstream and electricity transmission assets.
So what does this all mean for us? It's a highly asymmetric risk-reward profile, isn't it? It depends almost entirely on your individual view of a Colombian political risk, and your faith, or lack thereof, in economic pragmatism eventually prevailing over ideology. Hashtag outro. And that wraps up our deep dive into Ecopetrol SA. It's clear, I think, that this is a company with a strong operational base, some really impressive infrastructure assets, and undoubtedly a highly capable workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Yet its future, its very destiny, seems inextricably linked to the Colombian government's evolving energy policy and, maybe just as importantly, the broader political and security stability of the nation. It's a truly fascinating and at times, you could say, alarming example of how macroeconomic and political forces can completely overshadow a company's fundamental operational strengths. They can dictate its trajectory more than any traditional business metric sometimes.
This deep dive into Ecopetrol really shows us with vivid clarity that in the complex world of energy, especially for national oil companies or NOCs, the geopolitics of energy is often just as, if not more, important than the geology itself.
Geopolitics over geology.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. The constant gnawing tension between a nation's immediate fiscal needs and its long-term energy transition goals is a challenge many, many countries face right now. Colombia's current approach, playing out through Ecopetrol, offers a stark and powerful illustration of the potential consequences, both economic and social, when that balance becomes precarious or, some might argue, unsustainable.
So, a final thought for our listeners. The next time you hear about a country's energy policy, especially one heavily reliant on natural resources, maybe take a moment to consider Ecopetrol's story. How might a different path, a different political decision, impact not just the company itself, but the entire nation's future, its energy security, its economy, its social stability?
Mm-hmm.
And what might that tell us about the broader ongoing energy transitions playing out globally with all their inherent complexities and trade-offs?
A lot to think about there.
Definitely. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we encourage you, as always, to keep exploring and questioning the forces that shape our world.